Good to see you tonight. We appreciate you being here. Glad that some who've been sick are able to be out again, and we welcome our visitors. As already said, we appreciate you being here as well. We continue to study this evening on some things taught to us in the last verses of Romans chapter 1. Let us briefly remind ourselves, since it's been a couple of weeks since we were attending to this passage, that in chapter 1, Paul has charged the Gentile world with being under God's wrath because of their rejection of God. Verses 18 through 21 of chapter 1 says that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. It is made manifest. God's wrath is shown and revealed against all unrighteousness and ungodliness of men. And he says, as he explains this, that they knew God, verse 21, but they did not glorify Him as God. They chose rather to be unthankful and unbelieving and became futile in their thoughts. And their foolish hearts became darkened. Now, consequently, it says that God gave them up because they chose to reject the information, the evidence of God's presence and power. They chose not to be thankful. They chose not to believe in Him. Because God made mankind with free choice, they chose evil and God made a choice. God gave them up. God has said, if you choose sin, here's the consequences. Here's the result. Here's the punishment. And so He says He gave them up. It says in 24, He gave them up to uncleanness. Consequence of their unbelief and unthankfulness and their pride that contributed to their idolatry led to fulfilling the lusts of their hearts and all manner of uncleanness and dishonoring of their bodies rather than using their bodies in the honor of God. They worship and serve the creature rather than the Creator. And so again he says, for this reason, verse 26, God gave them up to vile passions to exchange what is the natural use of the body, both women and men, to doing those things that are unnatural, that are unholy, and thus all manner of shameful use of the body and defilement in sinful passions. Again, in verse 28, even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, they chose to refuse the evidence of God. They did not want to think about God. They cast God aside. And that caused, and God then says, I gave them up to depravity, to debased thinking, to all manner of defilement. And so in 28 through 32, he then gives us a whole list of sins, some of which we've already looked at, as one refuses to know God, all manner of sin begins to progress and really devolve into more and more spiraling of all manner of sin. So that now in verses 29 and 30, and really all of these tear at the fabric of society. Not only do they tear apart one's relationship with God, but when you refuse God and refuse to know God, not only have you destroyed a relationship with Him, but the sins that are chosen rather than righteousness and godliness tear at the very fabric of society. Societies will not stand. Communities will not hold together with all these manner of things going on. Whether it is the sexual immoralities or the covetous wickedness and malice that will show itself in all manner of evil and crime against of man against man, or whether it is envy and those things associated and produced by envy, such as murder and strife and deceit that we studied in our last lesson. And note please that in verse 29 it begins by saying they are filled with all unrighteousness, and then toward the middle of that verse it says they are full of. So being filled with unrighteousness, then they just are consumed by. They are running over with these sins. Now, We ended in our last study with evil-mindedness, and we want to look at the next grouping here of about five or six of these down through near the end of verse 30. So we're not going to look at a whole lot of them tonight, but we're going to try to pull them together in two or three different categories. And first, there are a couple of things here that we're going to call character assassins. Things that assassinate the character of other people. Of course, they demonstrate a faulty character within oneself when one chooses to do these things. But first of all, what we're talking about are people who are haters of men and haters of God. And we'll see that in 29 and 30 by saying they are whisperers, backbiters, and haters of God. We're going to look at those three words here for just a moment. Whisperers. Secret maligners. People who secretly speak evil of other people. They have whisperings. Gossip falls into that category. It is motivated by hate. Of course, gossip conceals that hate. You know, gossip sometimes it conceals the hate in as if it were with some good interest in another person, and so they're going to share this information. But really, at the heart of it is malignity. That is an evil motive, an evil desire, a hateful treatment of somebody else, not to help in terms of going to the person and discussing whatever the issue is and offering some aid, but simply castigating in a secret way, in a whispering way. Look how that's motivated by hate in Psalm 41 and verse 7. Now, the 41st Psalm. David is writing and he says, "All who hate me whisper together against me. Against me they devise my hurt." So David had enemies, remember? And he said they whisper. They plan together. They hate me. And because they hate me, they whisper. If you find yourself whispering about somebody, talking about somebody, instead of talking with that person about whatever it is you're whispering, first of all, you need to stop it. That's sinful. Secondly, you need to remove the hate from your heart, because in essence, that's what's being a fruit of that. Whispering's a fruit of hate. Now I want you to back up with me to verse 4. Because David said, and I want you to see here the two public and secret whisperings and malignings. He said, "Lord, be merciful to me. Heal my soul, for I have sinned against you." David sees himself as a sinner needing God's mercy. But you know, the whisperer doesn't seek the mercy of God for the one who needs it. No, whispering seeks to destroy somebody else. That's at the heart of it. And so David writes in 5, "My enemies speak evil of me. When will he die and his name perish?" See, they're not interested in helping David, but in seeing him perish. So they speak evil. "And if he comes to see me, he speaks lies. So this enemy comes to me and he speaks to me. His heart gathers iniquity to itself, and when he goes out, he tells it." So he comes to me as if he's a friend. He comes to me as if he's interested in me. But when he leaves, he goes out and he tells it. That is, he goes out and he speaks lies. "They hate me," he says, "and they whisper about me." Now, in Romans 1, we're taught that what this does is reflect that somebody is refusing to know God. Someone who participates in whisperings about someone is not someone who's living with a knowledge of God. They are living in opposition. They're practicing things that are opposed to the knowledge of God. It may be a tasty morsel. You know, that's kind of what gossip is. They got a tasty morsel and they got to tell it to somebody. But in the end, it's very hurtful. not only to the person telling it, but also to the reputation and well-being of the one being spoken against. Look at Proverbs 26:22. It says, "The words of a talebearer are like tasty trifles. They go down into the inmost body." So like a box of chocolates, right? It's a little tasty treat, but it causes a lot of hurt. Whispers. Speaking evil of somebody when they're absent, but you're not willing to say it when they're public, when they're present. Don't say it to them or concerning them when they're present, but you'll say it about them when they're not there. When they can't respond, when you can paint the picture yourself, and usually you see what it is painting that picture in a very derogatory fashion. Now, a couple of things about that. It's often accompanied by complaining and murmuring, and grumbling, arguing, disputings. You don't usually whisper about a friend, do you? Don't whisper about somebody that you really feel aligned with. Of course, as brethren, we're not to be treating anybody like that, especially our brethren. Do all things without complaining and disputing. Have no secret displeasure that you will not openly disavow, but secretly you'll whisper about it. He says don't do anything with that, like that. Speaking, whisperers, they assassinate people's character. They assassinate people's reputations. They make it difficult upon the person about whom they're whispering to have a godly influence, because you see the whispering is designed to destroy that influence, minimize it, reduce it, often by elevating oneself. And minimizing the other person, hurting and harming the other person's reputation and influence. You know, whispering is a cowardly sin. It's cowardly, as well as malicious. It's in a series of sins and problems in the church at Corinth in 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 20. Paul was fearful lest when he came he would find some of them still engulfed in such things as contentions and jealousies and outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, backbitings and whisperings, conceits and tumults. Rather than follow Jesus when he said, if a brother sins against you, go and show him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you've gained your brother. You see, whispering is not about gaining a brother. No, it's about destroying a brother. It's about this, a malicious tearing down. And when we no longer know God, then it's all about me anyway. It's all about setting myself forward and securing my place. And if that means whispering about somebody else and causing doubt about somebody else, then you know, he gets what he deserves, I guess. You know, that's kind of the attitude. It detracts from others. You see, it excites suspicion. Whispering excites suspicion. It stirs up the doubting and suspicions. Drops hints that they're not to be trusted, or they may not be so sound. Not really any evidence, not really any proof, but drop the doubt. Whisper about it. Before you know it, you will have eliminated somebody's influence for good. Not on any basis of fact and truth, but on the basis of your whispering, your malice, your hatred, and your cowardliness. Brother R.L. Whiteside wrote once, "Whisperers are cowardly sneaks who have not the courage to come out in the open and say damaging things about others, but secretly peddle their slanderous statements and insinuations against the objects of their campaign of spite. They usually add, 'Be sure not to include my name or use my name in connection with the matter. I don't want to get mixed up in the mess.'" That's pretty characteristic of the whisperer. You're going, talk about something, but oh, I don't want to get involved. Oh, I don't want to say anything. You know, that's the whispering. Brother Whiteside went on to say, such characters have been aptly termed snakes in the grass. They would destroy a good name and then gloat over what they've been able to accomplish. Only the Lord properly awards such characters. He will award such character. He will bring a just reward to that kind of ungodliness. Paul reminds us that's what happens when we refuse to retain God in our knowledge. We have to tear others down. We will invariably tear others down when we refuse to know God and try to secure our place in some way, even if it means whispering about somebody else in cowardly attempts to hurt and harm others. It's an expression of hate. It's a character assassination. He then uses the word backbiters, slanderers. Again, in somewhat similar to defame and to speak against, but the idea in this is it's a form of slander that is a little bolder than whispering, but it still doesn't really face the object of the slander face to face. You come around from the backside. You bite from the rear. And it's not a head-on confrontation about some problem, but again, you circle around to the rear and then you snap. It's slander. It's defamation. Now, that kind of thing does, according to Solomon or the wise man in Proverbs 25 and 23, he says that it causes anger. North wind brings rain, and a backbiting tongue and angry countenance. You can count on it. You start backbiting, you can cause trouble. You can cause somebody to lead them into sin as you sin against them. Backbiters do not abide with God. It's just God is very clear about that. He says, I'm not going to have fellowship with somebody who slanders other people, who speaks ill, who defames others. I'm not going to have it. I'm not going to be with it. I'm not going to be a part of my kingdom and my house. In Psalm 15, Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle, in your tent? Who may dwell in your holy hill? Who will you receive into your house, into your tent? He who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his mouth, in his heart, he who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend. You see, there's what backbiting does. It does evil. It takes up a reproach, a defamation against a friend. It is an ungodly use of the tongue. God says, that person's not going to be there. The one who refuses to do those things will be the one I'll receive. But if you do those things, you're not going to dwell in my tabernacle. You're not going to have a place of peace and security and fellowship with me. So we need to think about what we say and how we speak about other people. And if we have a conflict, if we have an unresolved dispute, we need to be people of character, integrity and honesty, who forthrightly address that with the person involved. It may be a complete misunderstanding, or it may be a willful sin, but in either case, we deal with it in God's way. Matthew 5 says, if we remember a brother has something against us and we're about to worship God, we go and solve that problem. We go and address that problem, and then we come and offer our gifts to God. We can't hold a grudge. We can't hold an attitude of hate towards somebody, of malice, and then bring an offering to God as if everything were fine. Backbiting illustrates that kind of a sin that we need to solve by communication and a resolution in truth and godly, as much as it is within us. you see. As much as it's in us to live peaceably with all men. Romans 12. That means we don't backbite. We try to solve. Psalm 101 and verse 5 says, "Whoever secretly slanders his neighbor, him I will destroy. The one who has a haughty look and a proud heart, him I will not endure." So, Jehovah says, I'll destroy the backbiter. He won't live with me. Just the opposite. Just the opposite. Character assassins. Let's be careful. We don't whisper. We don't backbite. Paul says also they are haters of God. Now, this is written in the passive voice, which some have concluded it would more rightly be translated hated by God rather than haters in some active way. But in either case, it seems clear that this sin is one of people who deny God. They deny the presence of God, the being of God, and the acts of God, the providence of God. They show themselves to be His enemies by how they live, by what they say, by what they think, by what they do. Haters of God. Now, again, when you don't want to think about God, you want to put God out of your mind, God says what ends up is you end up hating me. You end up speaking against me. You know, haters of God speak against God, blaspheme the authority of God with the disrespect and disregard and irreverence of such things. In 2 Timothy 3 and verse 2, Paul said that in the last days perilous times will come. Men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful and unholy and unloving. They will be lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. So rather than lovers of God, we have haters of God expressed by speaking against God and speaking against the authority of God. You know, there are people, and it's a sad thing, that there are people in the world that somewhere along their life, somebody mistreated them, somebody didn't do the right thing, somebody sinned, and they choose to take it out on God. They choose to hate God as a result of sinful people doing sinful things that hurt or harm them in some way. That's a sad thing. See, Satan will use that. He'll use our hurt and the hurt others cause us to try to get us to speak against God and say, I don't need God. And He's, you know, who needs that? It's not God's fault when others sin and when they sin against me. No, God is there to help me when others sin and to try to save them, but to help me when others sin against me, not to draw me into sin and become a hater too. It's a sad thing to see that happen in someone's life. What we have to do is continue to show the light of truth to them and recognize that it is through the love of God that there is redemption, not by becoming a hater of God. That simply hurts and harms oneself. 2 Peter 2 and 10 describes some of these people. It says there that especially though, and he's talking about some false teachers of the day and that would come, and it still is an apt description, especially those who walk according to the flesh in the lusts of uncleanness and despise authority. They're presumptuous, self-willed. They're not afraid to speak evil of dignitaries. Now, the hater of God despises who God is, despises the Word of God, the will of God, the authority of God, the power of God, the rule of God over himself. They prefer rather to presume, to be presumptuous. It's a trait of being self-willed, of pride, no doubt. But he says these people that he was warning them of, and warns us of, we're not afraid. They're not afraid to speak evil of those who have rank, who have authority, from God on down, you see. And to hate God, to hold God in contempt, for whatever reason. You know, it befuddles me. Really, that when somebody experiences a loss in their life, or there's sin that somebody has grievously sinned against them, it's just befuddling to me why somebody would blame God. Why someone would say, "Well, if that's, you know, that somehow or another," or somebody may be taken tragically from their life suddenly and unexpectedly, and they blame God. I just don't understand that. As if God is to be hated, you know, and I don't know. As if what? Are we supposed to live forever? Do we? So that if somebody dies unexpectedly, that somehow God's to be blamed, as if we're to always live and never die? The devil uses those things to try to turn our hearts from God. And you see, once we've decided that we're not going to retain God in our knowledge, it becomes easier and easier to blame God and to be disrespectful of the things from God and of God and about God, of His Word, His people. And that just plunges us still deeper into our sin and separation. But Paul goes on further. He's going to identify some sins of self-importance, is the way I've chosen to try to categorize or describe these a little bit. Sins of self-importance. And there's a couple here that we're going to look at. Depending on what your translation is, you may have three here. Or we're going to combine two of them. The New King James says, violent, proud, boasters. I think Jake's version that he read for proud said haughty. I think that's right. And there's some discussion about exactly how these fit together. We're going to look at them in this way. He talks about people who are violent and proud or haughty. We're going to talk about the violently arrogant. This is the person who approaches life in an insulting way, who insults others and really has no hesitation to do it. The word means one who's lifted up with pride and either heaps insulting language upon others or does them some shameful act of wrong. Insolent may be one of your translations of this word. It is somebody who is hurtful to others, hurtful in words. They just don't have a kind word to say. Their words just hurt. They insult. And Paul says this is part of this devolving into more and more sin. Let's look at 1 Timothy 1 and verse 13. Because there the word insolent is used. And Paul uses it, in fact, of himself before he was a Christian. And I think this gives us some insight into what this word is, what this sin is, to help us avoid it. It says, I was formerly a blasphemer, a persecutor, and an insolent man. But I obtained mercy because I did it ignorantly in unbelief. I was an insolent man. I was violently arrogant myself. I treated people contemptuously. I spoke to them hatefully. I treated them rudely, not merely impolite. I tried to see them die because of their faith in Jesus. You see, in Acts 9 and 1, then we have a description of what Paul meant when he said, I was insolent. I was a violent, arrogant person. Acts 9 and verse 1 says, Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked letters from the synagogues in Damascus. He is breathing out threats. He is instigating murder against the disciples, seeking to find them, to bind them, to cause them to blaspheme, he would say later in chapter 26 and 11, giving his vote to their death because of their faith. Look at chapter 26, 11. He said, I punished them often in every synagogue and compelled them to blaspheme, being exceedingly enraged against them. I persecuted them even to foreign cities. This violent arrogance, I suppose, could be no better illustrated than the barbarism we've been witnessing of ISIS and the beheading of innocent people. So violently arrogant and hateful and contemptuous. Paul said, I was that kind of person. Now you think, well, that kind of person can never be saved, but Paul was. He said, I did it ignorantly in unbelief. It can be repented of, this violent arrogance. But it will require a drastic humbling of the heart. And Paul did that. But you see, Paul says, now, understand that this is what happens. And you see, it wasn't that he was not a believer in God. He just rejected Jesus. And so he said, I was a blasphemer. 1 Timothy 1:13. He was speaking against God when he spoke against Jesus. If we don't believe the truth of God, we end up speaking against God. We end up being blasphemers. And even worse, we can become violent in that and insulting in a contemptuous way. Paul says that's sin. That's the sin of the Gentile world for which God's wrath comes upon an individual and people. And so we're taught not to render evil for evil. Not to render evil for evil. Romans 12, 18 through 21. And this is the test of our faith. When someone is contemptuous, when someone is insulting toward us. If it's possible, as much as it depends on you, live peaceably with all men. To be like Jesus when they are spitting upon Him, when this crowd is around Him, abusing Him, beating Him, spitting on Him, and He says not a word. And He had the ability to say a lot, to do a lot with just a word. But as much as in us, we're to be at peace with all men and not give way to revenge or to try to avenge ourselves, but give place to God's wrath. It's just. You see, vengeance belongs to God and He will repay. And so we're to overcome evil with good. Overcome even violent arrogance with good. Now God goes on to explain part of how He deals with such violent arrogance and such sinfulness. He's constituted authorities, governing authorities, to execute His judgment against such sinners. And so governments have the right to punish the evildoers who would so mistreat their fellow man. Paul said there's also the sin of boasters. Boasters, or haughty, and proud. These boasters make themselves more than they ought to be. More than what is justified by reality. They think more highly of themselves than they ought to think. A.T. Robertson said the word means empty pretenders, swaggerers, and braggarts. It is the bully who thinks of himself as big when he's really very small. Who is a braggart, conceited. Romans 12 says in verse 3 that let no man think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. You see, when we begin to become conceited, we lose sound judgment. We're no longer sober thinking. We're thinking more of ourselves and making more of ourselves than we ought to make. And so verse 16, he says, be of the same mind toward one another and do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion or your own conceits. It goes back to verse 3. Don't be high-minded. Don't think more highly of yourself. Because when you do, you end up being a boaster. And that's sin. You see, that's sin. It's the inflated estimation of ourselves. Two ways we see this play out. If we think more highly of ourselves than we ought to think. One is, in concluding that we don't need spiritual help and we ought to be helping the others. But we certainly don't need it ourselves. Galatians 6, 2 and 3. You remember in verse 1 he said, "You who are spiritual, restore such a one who's been overtaken in a trespass." But then look, and he says, "Consider yourself, lest you also be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. For if anyone thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceives himself." We think we're something when we're not. And we deceive ourselves. And in his context, it seems to be that he's describing the person who is unwilling to consider himself, that he might be tempted, that he might need help, that he might be overtaken in a trespass, and he's unwilling to bear another person's burden. Because you see, he certainly wouldn't have a burden that had to be borne. You see, so that other person just needs to suck it up. You see, an over inflated estimation of ourselves leads to us thinking we don't need spiritual help, or we don't need to help somebody else in their spiritual need. That's conceit. We need help at times, and we ought to be helpers of others when they need it. And if we don't think that way, then we're thinking wrongly. Could be that we've, in our own minds, become a boaster. We've inflated our view of ourselves. Now, secondly, look at 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 12. "Wherefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." Here's a person who has inflated his estimation of himself that a temptation will not overtake him, that he's on firm footing, he's got all of it put together, and he's not going to be tempted to turn away from God. "Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." Constant vigilance. But you see, the boaster is not constantly vigilant. He's estimated that he doesn't need to be vigilant. He's got that battle won already. And that's when we set ourselves up for the fall, just as Paul said. So we're to be careful not to be boasters. Now, character assassins, whisperers, and backbiters. These sins of self-importance, violent arrogance, boasting. Now look at inventors of evil things for just a minute before we conclude. Inventors of evil things. He's describing people who find new ways to sin. They go out looking for trouble. And they find it. He said, that's, you see, when people refuse to acknowledge God, don't want to believe in God, and say there is no God, then left to their own devices, inevitably we start satisfying ourselves, and there's going to be an element that just goes out looking for trouble. Proverbs 1, 10 through 16. Solomon warned his son. He tried to warn his son about this. He said, "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, 'Come with us, let's lie and wait to shed blood. Let's lurk secretly for the innocent without cause. Let's go and do our mischief.'" He said, don't follow them. Don't consent. Drop down to chapter 4 and verse 14. "Do not enter the path of the wicked. Do not walk in the way of evil. Avoid it. Do not travel on it. Turn away from it and pass on. For they do not sleep unless they have done evil. And their sleep is taken away unless they make someone fall." You see, there are people in the world. Now, and he says, they eat the bread of wickedness and drink the wine of violence. There are people in this world who are not content until they have done damage to somebody else. Until they hurt someone else. Maybe because they hurt. Maybe some other motive. But it's a sinful motive. It's an evil thing. And so, the wise man here is saying to his son, don't go that path. Don't go down that road. Don't walk with them. Recognize it. See them for who they are. They're out to cause trouble. They're inventing evil things. Because they don't care to know God. You don't care to honor God. In Jeremiah 4, verse 22, one of the sins, one of God's descriptions of the sins of Judah in that passage, well, I think fits into this description. It says, "My people are foolish. They have not known me. They are silly children or foolish children. And they have no understanding. They are wise to do evil, but to do good they have no knowledge. Oh, they had plenty of resources to do what was sinful. They were wise in the ways of the world, of sin and evil and wickedness. But they don't have any knowledge of doing good. They don't know me." You see, did you see the connection? They have not known me. If they had known God, they would have known to do good. But they didn't know God. They didn't know good. They knew evil. You see, we cannot escape his point that when we do not know God, that inevitably leads us to evil. To more and more, and to invent it, and to be resourceful in what is evil, but to be void of those things that are good. The seductress in Proverbs 7 is just an illustration of the point. In Proverbs 7, you remember, as the again, as Solomon is warning the man here, the son, to avoid this, it says that they may keep you from the immoral woman or from the seductress who flatters with her words. She is adept in flattery and temptation to lure the unsuspecting here, the young man void of understanding, verse 7, into the sin. She catches him, she kisses him, she allures him, she attracts him, and he falls right into the trap because, you see, she set the snare and he's ready for it. Verses 6 and 7, he goes on to describe it. And really the point that I want us to see here is that men and women go out looking to satisfy their lusts when they're not interested in satisfying the will of God. Rest assured, people go out to satisfy themselves. And the seductress went out to satisfy her lust. And she did. And the young man was foolish enough to think that he would find satisfaction, and he sinned greatly and grievously as well. Look, verse 6, "For at the window of my house I looked through my lattice and saw among the simple. I perceived among the youth a young man void of understanding." He was foolish. He wasn't wise. Seductress, this immoral woman, lured him, set the trap of evil, and he was not wise enough to see where it was going to take him. It took him to sin and despair. Inventors of evil things. We have to be wise enough to see where something's going and where the evil people are willing to take us. And we need to be willing to say, "I'm not going to go there. That's not the road I'm going to go." You see, the contrast is to the disciples of Christ. Jesus said, "I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves." Now get that picture. I want you to think about that with me here before we conclude. I'm sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Who would do such a thing? There's a pack of wolves and I'm going to send my sheep over there. Who would do that? Jesus. Now why would He do that? And how does He accomplish His point? He has the ability to protect us. He's the good shepherd. The sheep hear His voice and follow Him. They don't follow the wolves. See that? He gives protection, but look what He expects of us. Because you're going to be out there amongst the wolves and they want to devour you. Now I can protect you. John 10, 25, 26 and 27. If you'll hear my voice and follow me, I'll protect you. I'll secure you. You'll be in my hand, in the Father's hand, and no one's going to snatch you away if you'll hear me and follow my word, if you'll follow me. But you see, if you go after the wolves, you're going to be devoured. Now, watch it. He says, here's what I want from you. "Therefore be wise as serpents and harmless as doves." You be harmless. You be wise. You keep your eyes open. discern and know that there are inventors of evil out there in the world, and they want to drag you along with them in that evil because they don't know me. They don't know Jehovah God. They don't know the Son of God. And they want to take you down that road of destruction. You be wise. You be harmless. You rely upon the Good Shepherd, not the inventors of evil. Philippians 2, 14 through 16. We looked at 14 a minute ago. Paul said that we're to be harmless. He picks up that theme. He said, do all things without grumbling, without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God without fault, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I have not run in vain, neither labored in vain. You follow the word of life. You hold it forth. You shine it in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, in among the inventors of evil. Don't follow their path. It's a path of darkness and death. You be harmless. You be blameless. Without fault. You see, you don't be the one who invents evil, but keep showing the path and the light of what's true and good and pure and holy. And there'll be cause for rejoicing when Jesus comes. We are to harbor no ill will or contempt against those who invent evil, against those who whisper of us and backbite us, who are insolent and arrogant and violent toward us, or boasters, discounting us. We are to be harmless. We are to owe no man anything save love one another. No ill will. No contempt, but love our neighbor as God has loved us. You see, by not knowing God, people fail to value both God and man. When they refuse to retain God in their knowledge, they're going to become haters of God and haters of men. They're not going to value the people around them as being in the image of God. That's a foreign concept. You see, why do we show respect to others? Because we know others are made in the image of God. See, God has created us all. And we honor God, and therefore we honor His creation. Even the evil, we let God take care of them, and we do no harm. We're harmless, blameless, in the face of so much sin. Because we remember something else too as we close. We remember that we used to be there too. Just like Paul. Remember, he used to be there, and he became an example of how God, in His grace, can forgive and save. Look at Titus 3, 1 through 3. You see, we need to remember that while there's all so much sin around us, we need to not forget. We must not become boasters ourselves. But remember that we were there once, and the gospel delivered us out of that sin and corruption. Remind them, Paul tells Titus. Remind them to be subject to rulers and authorities, to obey and to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one. See, don't be insolent. To be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility toward all men, not haughty. For we ourselves were also once foolish and disobedient and deceived, serving various lusts and pleasures, living in malice and envy, hateful and hating one another. We used to be hateful. Now, we're not to be so. We used to be holding malice and expressing it through whispers and backbitings. We used to be arrogant, you see, and unresponsive to authority and disrespectful. But God was kind toward us. Verse 4. His kindness and love appeared in the Savior. The gospel called us out of that sin into life with the Son. Do you hear God's call tonight? Do you need to become a Christian? If sin has overwhelmed you, if you've been living in sin, practicing sin that's hateful toward God and toward men, God is calling you to put that away. In faith that Jesus is the Son of God, confess that faith tonight and change your heart. Repent of those sins against God. And in your repentance, be baptized for the remission of your sins. And then, being saved, walk with God and choose no longer to go the path of those who invent evil things to their own destruction. If you're a Christian, if you've fallen into sin, know there's a way out. You don't have to stay there. God is calling you. Come back. Repent. And forgive. In prayer, He'll forgive you. We stand ready to help you toward that end. Won't you come while we stand and we sing?